are listening to The Retirement Conversation, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join Joe and Dennis and learn from leading experts in the field, as well as the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our free workbook, access other free tools and resources, and learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to today's retirement conversation with our guest, Richard Eisenberg. Richard is managing editor of PBS's nextavenue.org, the PBS site for People 50 Plus, where he is also the editor of the Money and Work and Purpose channels. Previously, he was executive editor of Money Magazine, front page finance editor of Yahoo, and special projects director slash money editor at Good Housekeeping. He is the author of two books, How to Avoid a Midlife Financial Crisis and The Money Book of Personal Finance. Richard, welcome today. Thanks for your time. Is there anything you'd like to add to your bio?
No, that's all great. Thank you so much.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us. We're big fans of Next Avenue and your writing in particular.
Thank you.
For those who aren't familiar with it, could you please tell us about Next Avenue?
Absolutely. Next Avenue is a website for people in their 50s and 60s. It is from the PBS TV station in Minneapolis-St. Paul, Twin Cities Public Television, and it's been around since 2012. I'm the managing editor for the site. I'm also the editor of the Money Channel, which is personal finance, and the Work and Purpose Channel. And I've been with the site since we started back in 2012. We're trying to help people navigate their lives in midlife, in their 50s and 60s. So many of our stories are useful service stories. Some of them are entertaining and fun. Some of them are serious and poignant. Sometimes we're talking about our readers' parents. Sometimes we're talking about their millennial kids, but mostly we're talking about them. And we're trying to be useful. We're publishing new articles every day. Some of them are very timely and off the news, and others are just, you know, useful information that we think people would want to know. And I guess I would also mention that many of the Next Avenue articles are then republished on Forbes and on MarketWatch, and they are two of our media partners.
One area that I notice you often write about is the world of work for people 50 plus. And it seems like this era that we're all living through, is both the best of times and the worst of times for older workers. What makes this a great time to be an older worker, and what makes it so challenging?
Well, I do agree with you. There are some really great things about being an older worker these days and some things that are not so great. Some of the great things are the fact that those of us who are in our 50s and 60s, you know, can often use our knowledge, the expertise that we've accumulated over the decades of working to do our jobs better, to be more successful, to be more helpful, sometimes to start a business, sometimes to be an employee. So I feel like we're able to put to use a lot of the things that we've built up over the years. The challenging part, I think, is age discrimination. Sadly, there are still a lot of employers who either don't want to keep older workers, don't want to hire older job applicants, you know, and they have a lot of misconceptions about stereotypes. They assume things like older workers don't understand, aren't interested in keeping up with technology, that they maybe have one foot out the door towards retirement, they're not going to be productive. And, you know, most of these things are not true for most people. You know, I wish that we would see less of that. Now, lately, there's been some anecdotal evidence suggesting that some employers are now changing their ways. And I think it's mostly because they need older workers because of the tight job market. And, you know, whatever the reason, I'm happy that they're keeping older workers and hiring them. I just hope it's a long-term trend. I'm not sure that it is.
But as you point out, the business drivers make a big difference. They can actually help influence change. And I'm curious, what do you think employers could do to leverage older workers more?
I guess there are two things that come to mind. One is I feel they could do a better job training older workers to keep up with technology and the latest trends in the industries. You know, typically employers tend to focus training on younger workers, either ones who are just starting there, who've just been hired, or ones who've been there, you know, for a year or two or so, and they want to keep those younger people. And often the older people don't get that kind of training. So I'd like to see more of that. And on the flip side, I'd like to see more employers leveraging older workers by offering them what's called phased retirement. And by that, I mean there are a lot of people in their 50s and 60s who want to keep working for their employers, but not necessarily 5 days a week, full time every day, the way they have for a while. But what they like to do is, you know, gradually phase towards retirement. So maybe 4 days a week now and maybe 3 days a week next year. And very few employers offer that kind of arrangement. Some of them do it on an ad hoc basis, typically for the senior executives. I'd like to see more employers doing it because I think it's something that a lot of older workers would like, and it would let them continue to work and stay happy on their jobs.
It seems like such a win-win if some of the obstacles can be overcome. Great points. So in reading your writing, I noticed that you go to a lot of conferences. Makes me very jealous. There's some great ones that you go to. And from the conferences you've attended so far this year, what's jumped out to you as an emerging topic that should be on the radar of baby boomers?
Well, you're right. I am fortunate to be able to go to some conferences. I went to the American Society on Aging one. I was at the Gerontological Society of America conference and the What's Next Boomer Business Summit and the 2019 Silicon Valley Boomer Venture Summit. And I guess one of the trends that I noticed a lot at those conferences was the growth of midlife entrepreneurship. It seems like there are more and more people in their 50s and 60s who are starting businesses at that time of life or want to do so. One of my colleagues at Next Avenue, Carrie Hannon, who's a blogger for us, writes for us very often, has a new book out just on that subject called Never Too Old to Get Rich. And, you know, I think what's happening is there are a lot of people at that age who are saying, I want to try something on my own. I don't want to work for somebody else anymore. I've got this idea I've been thinking about for a while, and I think I'm ready to do it. And so I feel like that's an emerging topic that I think more boomers should be knowledgeable about and also learning how to do it right.
And I noticed last fall at the GSA meeting in Boston that you were named as a journalist and aging fellow with the Gerontological Society of America. And that's leading to you working on a project about what Americans can learn from residents of the world's high longevity blue zones to ensure that their money lasts throughout their increasing lifespans. What a fascinating topic. Could you share a few highlights of what you've learned and how'd you go about a project like that?
Sure. Well, I was intrigued by this whole idea of the blue zones. It was a best-selling book by Dan Buettner a few years back. And what he found was there are five parts of the world where people tend to live the longest and healthy. And so they are in Greece and Italy and Costa Rica, Japan, and even one in the United States. And there have been a lot of articles about these blue zones, but they were almost all focused on health and fitness and diet. So what are they doing to stay living so long? But what I wondered, because I'm a money and work writer and editor, is, well, how do the people who are living into their 90s and 100s in these places manage to make their money last their long lives? And then what can the rest of us learn from them? So I started researching that, and I interviewed a lot of people who are experts on this, who've interviewed these people in the five blue zones. I was lucky enough to go to one of the blue zones in Costa Rica in the Nicoya Peninsula, where I met with a lot of centenarians and learned from them. And I also was able to go to the Blue Zone in the United States. It's in Loma Linda, California, which is about 60 miles east of Los Angeles. And it's a Blue Zone because there are so many Seventh-day Adventists there. And because of their healthy habits, they don't drink, they don't smoke. Many of them are vegetarians. They often lead very long, healthy lives. What I thought was interesting was the way these people make their money last is quite different around the world. I would say the four places outside of the United States that are blue zones were very similar to each other, and then the United States one was more of an outlier. In the other places, people tend to make their money last partly because they get great support from their families, and often big families. The daughters and granddaughters and sons and grandsons and sometimes spouses are either living with them or living near them and providing caregiving and just being helpful. And then also in many of these other countries, there is government-provided health care so that if there are health costs for these older people, they pretty much know they're going to get covered by the government for regular health care costs and long-term care costs. Those people in those places typically did not save or invest. Some of them put money in the bank, but many of them didn't. They all got a small government pension, and they felt that they could live on that, and they did. In the United States, it was very different. In Loma Linda, the people there are diligent and regular saving and investing people. They've been doing it since their 20s because they know they're going to last long lives and they want to be sure that they don't run out of money. They know that we don't have government-provided health care, although we do have Medicare and we have Medicaid for some people. So they were more serious about saving and investing. They tended not to rely on families so much for helping them out for caregiving. And so it was much more on their own. And I just thought all that was very interesting.
What surprised you the most?
I guess what surprised me most was how little the people in the other countries around the world are saving and investing for retirement. I just assumed that they'd be doing that everywhere in the world, and they're not doing that so much, and yet they find that they can manage. Now, I would tell you that most of those people live very frugally. They are not living with, they don't have fancy cars or fancy houses. They're not spending much. They're not traveling much. So they're living okay, they're happy with their lives, but they're not living, I would say, luxurious lives. And I guess I was a little surprised that there was a blue zone in the United States. And I was surprised in California how impressive these people were in the way they save and invest. And not just in stocks and bonds, although they do that a lot, but a lot of them also invest in rental real estate. And they've been doing that for quite a while.
So let's say there's someone like me who's turning 62 and talking to you today from suburban New Jersey, not exactly a blue zone. And they read your series on the blue zones on nextavenue.org, and they want to apply it in their own life. Where would you recommend that they start?
I think the first thing I would tell people is to do whatever you can to stay healthy or get healthy. And the reason for that is not just because it's good for you, but it will help keep your healthcare costs down in retirement. So if you're lucky enough to live a long life, you'll be less likely to have very high healthcare costs, which are going to eat into your savings. And then the other thing I would say is it's really important to be saving and investing regularly, not only up until retirement, but even in retirement. And so that means, you know, putting money into mutual funds or ETFs on a regular basis, maybe doing it automatically through your bank where money is automatically taken out all the time, using IRAs, using 401ks, just being sure that you continue to do it. And if you haven't been doing it, begin doing it.
And what's one thing that people who are planning for retirement may not be thinking about, but really should be?
If it's okay, I think I'll give you two. One of them is, will I be able to keep working part-time if I want to? There have been some interesting studies that show a lot of people in their 50s and 60s expect to work part-time in retirement. And yet, when you look at the surveys of retirees, you find that a very small percentage of them are working in retirement. Many of them aren't because of health reasons. So I think people just need to think, well, is it realistic that I'll be able to work in retirement? Partly, you know, will I be healthy enough to do it? But also, will I be able to find work? Will I be able to get hired? Or will I be able to start a business? So I think that's one thing I would tell people to think about. And the other is, if you are in a long-term relationship and have a spouse or a partner, are the two of you on the same page about retirement? We've done a few articles on Next Avenue about couples and retirement and seen some studies that show that frequently couples don't talk with each other much about what they expect retirement to be like for them, how they plan to spend their time and their money. And then what happens is they get retired and then one of them is planning to travel a lot and the other is not planning to travel at all. And they don't want to be living different lives, but they hadn't really thought it out because they never had to. So I suggest couples talk about this more.
Great points. A lot of great information. Appreciate it. And in closing, Richard, how can people best follow your work going forward?
Well, you can read nextavenue.org, which is the website that I work at. You can follow me on Twitter, Rich Eyes, R-I-C-H-E-I-S 315. That's R-I-C-H-E-I-S 315. I'm also on Facebook and I'm on LinkedIn. We have a free newsletter that we do twice a week that tells people about some of the stories that we've been publishing. So I'd encourage people to sign up for that. You can do that on Next Avenue. And you might see our stories on Forbes and MarketWatch as well. And we would love to have more readers. And we'd love to hear from people about ideas that they have for stories we should be doing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a great podcast with our guest, Richard Eisenberg, today. Joe, what stood out for you today?
Two things, among others, but two I'd focus on. First, his comments about if you want to work longer really hit home, because so many people in all the surveys that are done each year comment these days indicate that they do want to work longer. It's the majority of people by far. But as he pointed out, most don't. So there's a gap there, and he talked about some of the reasons behind it. I'd add a couple of things just to expand a little bit in terms of what I've seen. One is the question of what do you want to do, because it really varies. A lot of people want to work, many because of reasons beyond financial, meaning, purpose, et cetera, things we've talked about often, he writes about often. So I think the question of what do you want to do is important, because is it something you're considering that's similar? Are you going to, do you want to do the same work, or do you want to do something different? And I'd break the different question down into subparts to explore. Is it related to what you do today, or is it something radical? And if it's radical, you want to start looking at who's doing that today, who can you talk to, advice that we have from the authors of Designing Your Life. But really look into how are they doing it, what are they doing? If it's something related, how can you convert, how can you leverage those skills that you've earned in your career and built over time to do it? Second thing that jumped out to me was also his commentary on what employers can do to leverage older workers more in the future. And I think that's a very hot topic. We also talked about companies getting involved, investing more in training intentionally for older workers. And I think that's a very wise investment. And he also talked about phased retirement. So I think those are things that aren't being done enough. Hopefully we'll start to be done more, but they're great areas for companies to focus on.
Joe, what do you think employees can do to help themselves in that regard?
So my question was for him about what the employers can do, but I think that's a great follow-up. On the individual side, I have seen some value, depending on the person and the company, in people starting to explore what could they do for themselves, meaning what courses are available at my company and outside that I could look at, and have a conversation with the people you work for. If it's the more job-related, the better. But I think that budgets being what they are, there's always constraints, but you might find that people are supportive if you want to build your skills, particularly in what you're doing today, and maybe more open to it. Phased retirement, same thing. The number is under 10% of companies with formal phased retirement programs, mostly because of the benefit plan complications and legal issues. But I've seen in my HR career, that at least the company I work for, and I know it's true elsewhere, often more open to one-off arrangements. Now, that might not be fair. There's some issues with that. But if you're talking as an individual, have conversations about people. Can you negotiate some type of flexible work arrangement that'll allow you to create your own phased retirement?
That's a great point. People, however, may be reluctant to have those conversations with their employers. What recommendations might you have for somebody like that?
Well, first of all, I think they should be. I hate to say that, but I think that they should. It's an important conversation, and you want to make sure you're intentional about it, but you're also aware of the potential consequences. So I think it's about doing your homework, meaning what other people do you know who are using flexible work arrangements and have negotiated at your company or elsewhere? So you want to kind of gauge the acceptability of it, the use of it. Is your company doing it elsewhere, or are you the pioneer? So I'd look at that first. I'd do my homework about what it's about, what people have seen. And then I would really echo the advice that Paul Rupert of Respectful Exits gave when we spoke to him on this podcast. And that's really about looking at it from a business standpoint, meaning a lot of people in making those proposals and negotiations look at it from our point of view. I would like to do this because it's going to benefit me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He really advises flipping the script. Look at it from what's it going to do for your manager? How can you make them, him or her, look good? Is always a wise consideration. But look at it from the business standpoint and build a business case in terms of how it's going to help the company, how it's going to help that individual manager. And I think that's wise advice. So do your homework and do the business case.
That's great advice. So really focusing on helping the business achieve their goals is really important here.
I think it improves the odds, it changes the perspective, and they're used, as Paul Rupert pointed out, they're used to looking at decisions like that all day. So it puts it in a frame in which they're more comfortable.
Great.
Thanks for joining us today on The Retirement Conversation. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.